Speaking of reliability, friends talking about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schankelberg.
And this is Kirk Gray.
Hey, Kirk. Good. You know, we were just talking, right, about a range of different things. And somehow we came back to Mill Handbook 217. Is that like your favorite standard or something? Is that I'm poking you here.
Yes. Good old Mill Handbook 217. It's a favorite topic because it's still being circulated and still being used by surprisingly many industries and even private companies or commercial companies. And it's, of course, over 22 years since it's been last updated, I think. And electronics has changed quite significantly. But we did see a recent article, and I do compliment Craig Hillman, who is the head of design for, what is it?
DFR Solutions.
DFR Solutions, yeah. Yes. Craig Hillman, who was a part of CALS at one time and came out and started a company. And Craig makes some excellent points that Professor Michael Pecht of CALS has also echoed in the past and tried to keep pointing out that Mill Handbook 217 is not only inaccurate and not valid, not really current by 22 years, but it's a misleading approach. In fact,
I think they both talk more about the approach. Yeah. The fundamental concept of adding up the failure rates of individual components just ignores it's a simplistic approach.
Right.
On the face of it.
And it was very simplistic.
And one of the things, and it was Craig's article that I appreciated because he talked about in the early days of reliability engineering, and it was more of a military and space exploration and Air Force guys and everybody else were saying, you know, we got to make this stuff last longer. Mm-hmm. And they were diving into the physics of failure. I don't know that it was called that at the time, but they were, you know, sorting out failure mechanisms and working out models and doing accelerated testing and doing all kinds of cool stuff. Mm-hmm. But then I'll blame it on the Navy because I was in the Army. They said, well, this is too complicated. We need something quick. And so they said, well, in theory, if we know the failure rate for all of the individual components, then that'll give us a rough estimate of it, and we can do the math without a computer.
Right,
which weren't plentiful in the 60s.
Fred, this is making one huge misguided assumption, and that is that the failures in the field are caused by intrinsic mechanisms in the components.
I think if you gather up data – now, this one. I'm not trying to defend 217, but if – like and I've worked with product lines and it's particular products, and you know there's a family of products that go out the field.
Right.
But let's say I have a laptop and I have a problematic hard drive.
Yes.
Or power supply. Let's pick on power supplies, right?
Yes.
All right. If I know that it's this op amp or it's this one component, it's this capacitor, and it's because of we just don't have the right design or it's abused in the field, or it gets hit with too much ESD all the time, or whatever reason, I can get a failure rate for that component if I do the failure analysis to say, yeah, it was that part.
Well, you just mentioned three different mechanisms that could cause it to fail.
I know, but you
don't know what that's going to happen.
No, but if I send you a laptop yesterday and I send you a laptop today, the range of stresses and everything else, it slowly evolves and people do more crazy things with our products. But in general, if I have last year's history of this, it's reasonable to predict next month's failure rate.
Well, yeah, that's kind of like the insurance actuarial table.
Right.
You might be able to say that these rates of failure, but that doesn't get you any better reliability, and you don't know what
But that's it's just tabulating up stuff, and it's not helping me design anything, but it helps me know what my expected failures are.
Right. And if you were to manufacture, like, I've had, you know, people, I think Chris talked to me about one guy that said that he had all these numbers for servers. He found somebody, you know, in a data center, and mm-hmm. he could predict the rate. Well, yeah, when you spread the number across a huge number of servers, and if everything's about the same, then you make this very general average number. But that doesn't help you improve the reliability of any products. And it just gives, you know, hey, this, if we make as good or poor quality as we have, this is what's going to fail. This is the rate at which we see failures. But that's not making it more reliable, nor trying to improve reliability. It doesn't do anything to do that.
Wait a minute. Now, 217 is not to be a design for reliability tool. It was never intended to predict actual performance.
No. I know that. Of course, I know that.
Where it gets in a lot of trouble. But we should actually mention the name of the article. I don't think we did that yet.
Okay.
Once you read it,
we'll put a link, and you'll put a link. I don't know.
Yeah, you put a link in it.
Okay. Well, we'll do something with it. Anyway, we'll give you it's called The End Is Near for Mill Handbook 217 and Other Outdated Handbooks. That's kind of, that's a hope. You know, the end has been near for, I guess, maybe 15 years, but unfortunately it hasn't ended. And because I don't know, I think you just pointed out, because it's simple, it gives you a number. That's what management's looking for. Reliability has a very long period of time to be the proven or disproven or mm-hmm. shown, demonstrated in the field. Yep. And by the time that it becomes painful, forget about whatever was predicted or estimated. It doesn't matter. You're struggling. You're fighting fires to try and keep your product alive.
Yeah.
Now, like.
Craig brought up some interesting points. I think one of the key thing I took away from his article was that in the early days, there was this. They were doing the physics of failure type mm-hmm. stuff and approach. And I know Michael Pecht and others have written about this also. But they also needed something that they could do today with what they had, which was mechanical adders and simple computing equipment.
This had a few discrete components. I mean, it was very simple. You could
I have 25 capacitors and I have 15.
Million transistors like you do today.
No, they didn't have silicon. It was all vacuum tubes and, you know, crap like that. And so they, you know, tallied it up and they say, well, and so one of the pivotal things I ran into early in my career is that after the very first time I tried to do a parts count prediction for some project, I went back to Dick Moss, who I was working with, and I said, this doesn't make much sense. And he goes, yeah, that's true. So then why am I doing it? And he says, it has an effect on the design teams that's beneficial to reliability. If they reduce the heat.
Use less components.
Seriously, if they use less components and they keep it cooler, it does better.
And that's their belief.
No, it actually, it does.
Well, I can point to articles that it's misguided. The Arrhenius relationship is not very strong for most of the semiconductor mechanisms,
this is before, this was all TTL logic all kinds of older technology.
A tube with filament, a vacuum tube with filament, if you run it hotter, it's probably going to fail sooner. Just like if you were to run a light bulb with more energy, you know, brighter, it's going to fail. Yes.
The one over my stove fails all the time.
That's certainly relevant. That's a physics of failure.
So, but the problem is that our technology has moved on, right? We've moved on from those.
At magnitude, sure.
Right. So I think, and then the other thing you were bringing up, and I cut you off, is that it's not always the individual component failure rates. Because I've heard the argument from folks using it today is, well, they don't use the numbers in the standard, whether it's Telcordia or wherever, because those are old and they're not relevant to their product and their environment. They use their internal data if they have it, or they go to the vendors to get it. But what that misses oftentimes, especially the vendor data, is those interactions. Was, well, what margin well, did sure. you design around this thing? How are you using it in your design? Those interactions with the other components and parts right. of your circuitry, that gets lost in using a generic vendor claim that it's this has this failure rate.
Yes, no, of course. The component could have a high voltage spike hit it several times. It's so fast that people don't damage it, but they're making the assumption that there's something problem with the component, not the circuit it's in. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. so many times it's a circuit it's in. It's right. it's something to do with the circuit's variations, or I mean, it's just it's the failure of a solid state circuit can be extremely complex, and it's usually not one functional reason. You know, one reason as a defect in a component, or the component's life is used up. It's usually very, very complex, and it's very difficult to find. And that's why Craig made the point that empirical handbooks are based the misconception that empirical handbooks are based on actual field failures. They don't know when the parts came back, what caused the field failure, where it happened in a system, yeah. what anything about, really anything about it. And you're talking about thousands and hundreds of thousands or 120,000, you know, thousands of components, he points out.
You don't know if it's
efficient, a misused part, a misused application. They plugged it into the wall with a wrong voltage, or they did something and it got, you know, lightning struck that circuit. They don't know. They came and they send back the part. The part gets counted as a failure, and it's calculated in these bizarre rates that don't have anything to do with the reality.
Yeah.
They don't have anything to do with reality.
Well, you remember Pat O'Connor, right? Have you heard him speak or talk in various places?
I think so. Yeah. In the past. He's
and he's got a great book out there. Him and Andre right. Kleiner helped him do a new addition to it.
Right.
But one of the things I saw Pat, and it was at a Greg Hobbs event. He was on the panel with talking about stuff, and I was listening in. And somebody asked him about parts count. And Pat says, now look, when I was in the military, he was in the British Air Force, and he was a radio repairman, is mm-hmm. the story he was telling. He goes, it was years later I found out that the data that we were collecting on what components we swapped out of these old radios mm-hmm. was used as the basis for the British version of the 217. It was
right.
And he goes, and I knew at that point that it was just poppycock. And he probably used right. some other more interesting term. I don't right. remember. But he said that as a repairman, we were, basically get it fixed as quick as you can. And so we often just had a whole handful of parts. So the ones that we figured were the most likely ones to cause the problem, and we'd swap them all out. And then we'd list down what we switched and if it was even close to accurate, but we didn't have time to do failure analysis and sort out details of what, and it was just, it might have been one piece that was drifted and we replaced 15 pieces and it got it working. So it was off our bench. And so vast majority of them were getting blamed for failure rates that weren't their fault. And then all the other things you just talked about. And at that point it was my first real experience with these parts count things. And I was like, yeah, this really doesn't make much sense. But I didn't really know enough to get into the physics of failure stuff.
And why do you keep, Fred, why do you always refer to parts count? Because there is much deeper levels of Bill Hembeck 217, which are being used, which is the Arrhenius space, where you take the activation energy of a mechanism and you apply to all these components that have different activation.
Oh, I do hand waving all over it. There's the maturity of the manufacturer, the quality level,
all these factors that you can add in.
Plus and minus all this other
and
stuff.
And that just makes it even more so inaccurate. Look, I quote Craig's article. A standard piece of electronic has approximately 200 unique part numbers and 1,000 components. About 20 of these 200 unique parts will be integrated circuits. This is directly from his article. Mm-hmm. Off the top of my head, each integrated circuit will have 12 possible ways to fail in the field. including dielectric breakdown, electromigration, hot carrier injection, bias, temperature instability.
Only if it's made EOS, correctly.
EMI, right. And all of these, right, depending on the manufacturing process and the geometries and, you know, and as we've seen in semiconductor technology, the density, the line width, you know, it's getting down to a few molecules wide in the wires. And that changes the physics, and it changes the energy, and all these things like temperature, bias, temperature instability, electromigration. All of those mechanisms change, and the activation energy, or the rate at which they occur, or when they're, you know, would naturally wear out or cause a what would be a normal intrinsic mechanism that fails, may take years. And my argument is
cold solder joint most of the time.
Yeah, those are manufacturing or process defect. Most of the time, the intrinsic things in semiconductors. I'm excluding batteries, I'm excluding motors, I'm excluding things that do have physical wear. But the vast majority of electronics, there's some, I say 70% or maybe more. Technological obsolescence comes well before those known intrinsic mechanisms, such as electromigrations, dielectric breakdown, all those generally have become manifest as a failure mode. More likely, when I see a failure, especially in the early, within 3 years of use of a solid state circuit, it's got to be, in my mind, that somebody overlooked something. They didn't have enough margin. They didn't have enough. They used the wrong component that was not significantly capable of doing this function. Mm-hmm. Those kinds of things. Okay, it can be so. Or the customer abused it. He used it in a misapplication.
You and I both have kids that drop phones, so it's right. You know, it's like
exactly.
Yeah, and exactly. I agree. There's a lot. If it's built correctly, electronics does a great job, right? The unfortunate part, and why I appreciate Craig's article so much, is that there's still such a reliance on these methods that they don't take into account the early life failures, the decreasing failure rate part. It's just averaged into the big old pool. And then on the other end, I agree with you more so than I do with Craig on the physics of failure stuff. Yeah, you can sort out the electromigration piece, and if you get that wrong. Right. In a design, and you make 100,000 chips and they all fail in a year due to that phenomena. Mm-hmm. That's a bad design.
Right.
And that does happen. Right. And it's catastrophic
for
a product.
Like I say, overlooked margin
design
flaw.
But that's where
we have so many computer aided design tools that can show you, follow those design rules.
Yeah, that's why we still have those problems. We still have those problems, though. People are pushing the margins. They want to get more and less space, new technology. And even the newest technology has boundaries that are vague until we get experience with it. And people are pushing those things. And I think it has a place, right? Especially when you're pushing new technologies.
What has a place? The reliability of physics of
the
failure.
The physics of failure part is,
yes,
because
I agree.
As we get making our, we're making all this stuff smaller and smaller, and the different, electromigration in particular, it's becoming, we're putting way more current on a much smaller wire. And so the opportunity for it to happen is really increased unless you get it right.
As we reduce the dimensions and the line width and everything, and we also are trying to reduce voltages and the stresses in the chip too. Now, one of those we may reduce, we're not correlated. Or in other words, as we reduce the line widths and essentially the field strength inside the chips and stuff like that, one of them may not be adequate to extend that life.
Right.
But
we get a chip out, right? We get the new Intel processor out, and they got it all vetted out and they worked it all out. And the workstation guys tried it for a couple of years, and it's now a common process. It's not leading edge anymore. At that point, we don't need to do a prediction based on part, you know, electromigration and the 13 other ways that it could theoretically fail. Right. It's get it soldered correctly and don't put it on a something that's going to flex.
Exactly. You know? Right. There'd be a lot of understood and known common causes that people, you know, good designers just know not to do and follow good design rules. But my point, and the point of all of these things about physics of failure and what we know, is that most of our failures, especially in the early part, you know, first years of use, are very costly because either they're warranty costs to the company and also setting the market. Market share. That these can be much more costly to a company than the warranty costs, the loss of market share or loss of the market because you've got crappy equipment. I'm hearing, you know, pinball machine companies are brand new in this field are possibly losing their market because of the fact that they're have not focused on reliability and making sure that it'll operate in a high use environment.
It goes to every industry though.
To every industry, right. But I'm, you know, observing very closely. But anyway, yes, when you're producing a new product and you have it fail in the first couple of years, that's the most critical time. If it fails in 5 years, and people are much more accepting of that and say, I got my money out of it, I got my use out of it, whatever. If it goes 10 years, it's probably going to be so slow like a computer that you're not going to want to use it. It's just, you know, not capable.
Yeah. Well, I'm trying to get that 10-year mark on my car. I upgraded it for a radio, and I'm holding on to it for a while. It's good now.
I have an old Lexus. It's a really nice car, but it's almost 20 years old. But I'm looking at all the safety features, all the other benefits of current cars, like rear backing cameras, all the airbags that you have. And now with the new automated cars that can, you know, actually stop you before you hit something possibly and have driver assistance and, you know, having a teenage daughter. I'm not encouraging her to get her license yet. She's turned 15, but boy, let's hold that off, you know?
Yeah, good luck with that.
But now, that's what drives me to want a new car. It's not so much that, I'm not paying a lot. I don't have a lot of repairs. It's been pretty reliable. Unless you want to put the explicit on your podcast. Anyway, that's what I'm looking for. And that's what almost always buy a new product, like a new PC, not because so much our old PCs failed. I've got them set around here just like my old CD players and my old VCRs, my old video cassette recorder that I have them sitting around. They would run. They would work. I could stick a tape in if there's a tape around.
Yeah. If Netflix then doesn't have it. Like,
what did the design engineer for these products say? Oh, it's got to last 5 years. Well, good luck if the technology lasts 5 years.
That's right.
The method.
Well, you know, that might be a topic for another discussion. Is this the impact on the design philosophy of putting this stuff together? Yeah.
Yes.
But let's save that one. Okay. I want to wrap this one up. Hopefully you as the listener are not using 217 or are similar
FIDES or all these others.
Yeah, they're similar approach. Yes. You really need to think it through. And, you know, if you've got an argument of why you need to use it and you want to join the conversation or you agree, either way, we'd love to hear from you. So you can go over to I finally set up a page that's just for this purpose, to get feedback and to have you as the listener join the conversation. So go over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR, which is our shorthand for speaking of reliability. So hopefully that's remembered. It's ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. And let us know what you think. And what's the, is 217 and it's similar and it's progeny is, are they working their way out of your industry? And hopefully that's true.
Let's hope so. 22 years is too long.
I think we've had our problems with it longer than that.
Yeah.
But anyway, we'll wrap it up there. So thanks, Kirk. And thanks,
Fred,
for bringing up that article. I know I saw it a while ago, and I'm glad we refreshed it, and we'll put that in the notes.
I'm glad Greg put it out there again. We need to keep pounding away on this.
That's it. All right. Take care, Kirk. Talk to you later.
Okay, Fred.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.